Hello and welcome to Forum. I'm Andrew Gilligan and this is the topical debate show where the people ask the questions. 2 days ago, the UN Security Council received what's said to be a negative report from its nuclear weapons inspectorate, the IAEA, on Iran's nuclear program. Britain and America are calling on the Iranians to abide by the obligations they signed up to under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But if the British government is so worried about proliferation, why is it developing its own new nuclear arsenal? Why has the UN now backed India's acquisition of the bomb, even though India never even signed the treaty? And why does no one mention that Israel, which never signed the treaty either, possesses between 60 and 80 nuclear weapons? The Iranians say all that proves the international arms control regime is hypocritical. There's one rule for them and another rule for US allies like Pakistan and Israel, even though both of those countries are focuses of instability in their respective regions. Others say that argument is ridiculous. And like the Iranian president, Israel's leader has never threatened to wipe anyone off the page of history. And like Iran, India and Britain are secular democracies. So who's right? Is international arms control a busted flush? Or does Iran's behavior make it perfectly reasonable for the world to be more alarmed about an Iranian bomb than any other kind? With me in the studio, an expert panel to answer your questions. To my right, Rebecca Johnson, director of the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy, a former advisor to Hans Blix and a one-time disarmament campaigner for Greenpeace. On her right, Robert Fox, one of the doyens of British defence journalism. For 25 years, he's covered wars and insurgencies across the world for the BBC, the Daily Telegraph and now the London Evening Standard. To my left, Paul Ingram, Executive Director of the British-American Security Information Council, a disarmament and anti-nuclear think tank. And on his left, Alan Mendoza, Director of the Henry Jackson Society, which believes that only liberal democratic states are fully legitimate, and that any international organization which admits undemocratic states on an equal basis is fundamentally flawed. The Society supports a forward strategy, including, if necessary, military action, to assist those countries which are not democratic to become so. Welcome to you all. And our first question is from Ian Drummond. Ian, your question.
How do the nuclear weapon states and the UN Security Council justify their possession of nuclear weapons, and on what authority do they deny the same right to others, such as Pakistan, North Korea or Iran?
Alan Mendoza.
Well, first, Pakistan obviously does have the bomb, as does North Korea, in that sense. But it's justified, firstly, they've had weapons, most of them, for a long time, basically. Secondly, they were developed many years ago, and therefore you're talking about disarmament rather than proliferation. I think everyone in the international community agrees that proliferation is a problem, whoever gets the new weapons as such. And I think the countries that have at the moment are keen that these should not be enhanced, that there should be not further proliferation of weapons, because they're very dangerous if they fall into the wrong hands. And I think the question today about Iran is whether they're going to fall into the wrong hands, and that's why there's such a strong reaction to Iran having the weapon as well.
Paul Ingram.
I think there's some truth to that, in the sense that there's a dynamism here. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty agreed in 1967 was essentially about both non-proliferation and disarmament. The trouble is, of course, is that I think a lot of countries, the nuclear weapon states, have seen this as legitimizing, underlying their possession of nuclear weapons, which it doesn't do. It says quite clearly in the Non-Proliferation Treaty that they have to disarm their nuclear weapons. Now, this is why so many of us are pointing at the British, at the American renewal of their nuclear weapons and their upgrading, and even people as right-wing and hawkish as Henry Kissinger and even Paul Wolfowitz is coming on side to the idea that we cannot continue along the same route that we have done up to now. So their justification, to answer your question, is that it's written down in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but equally they have responsibilities to live up to their commitments, and I think there is an increasing band of people across the political spectrum who are recognizing that it's not a sustainable position. Either Iran or indeed other countries will start to acquire nuclear weapons, which is a horrific future. I think everybody from whatever country they come from needs to recognize that more and more states without nuclear weapons is destabilizing, or we go to the world that was promised us back 30 years ago, which is a world without nuclear weapons.
Rebecca Johnson, you're an expert in these treaties. Just in a legalistic sense, tell me how strong the disarmament obligation under Article 4 actually is in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I mean, I read that. It doesn't look all that strong to me. It's quite vague.
Well, that's part of the problem, but the disarmament obligation is actually Article 6. But I have to correct one point. The treaty, when it was signed in 1968, entered into force in 1970, did not legitimise nuclear weapons for anyone. It simply made as a definition point that there were five countries that were going to be defined as nuclear weapon states because they'd already conducted a nuclear weapon test and had some nuclear weapons. And those were given an obligation that I agree was in very woolly language about, you know, a commitment to negotiate in good faith on ending the arms race, on nuclear disarmament, and then towards general and complete disarmament. However, the key difference is the treaty we now have today is not that treaty from 1970. It's the treaty that was extended in 1995. And this is a critical point. That treaty from 1968 was agreed to be only for 25 years. There had to be a decision about whether or not it would continue or be allowed to fall. And that had to happen in 1995. And at that point, the non-nuclear weapon states, countries like Iran, but also, you know, a whole vast number, you know, countries like South Africa, which had had a nuclear arsenal and given it up. A lot of countries that had thought about getting nuclear weapons had given up that possibility and joined as non-nuclear weapon states, got together and said, we are not satisfied that the nuclear weapon states are taking their disarmament obligation sufficiently seriously. So they put a stronger set of principles and objectives for nuclear disarmament as well as non-proliferation. And this was adopted by consensus, by complete consensus of everybody in 1995 as part of a package together with the extension of the treaty. Now what that means is that the treaty that now lives as the Non-Proliferation Treaty actually has much, much stronger, clearer obligations on nuclear disarmament. And in fact, 5 years later at another conference, they spelled some of these things out, and this is where you get where the nuclear weapon states agreed an unequivocal, and I'm quoting here, unequivocal undertaking to accomplish the total elimination of their nuclear arsenals, irreversibly, transparently, getting rid of the tactical nuclear weapons and the strategic nuclear weapons. This was all part of a plan of action of 13 steps agreed in 2000, and Britain took great pride in claiming credit for having actively negotiated this and helping to bring, you know, France and the United States into that agreement.
Okay, Robert Fox, can we really equate Iran and Britain? Isn't it reasonable for Britain to want nuclear weapons if Iran is developing its own?
I think that this is the real problem, Andrew. I would say it's the mixture between reason and emotion, and instinct and fear and terror and panic about this. The instruments that we've heard from the other panelists about the provenance, the origins of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, it is a world away from us today because it is basically a Cold War concept, because it could really work in circumstances of bilateral nuclear deterrence. The exam question is, does nuclear deterrence work in a multilateral world? And it's very interesting, having heard from Rebecca, where we went in 2000 of Britain introducing these instruments. Look at the reasoning in the white paper that came out at the end of last year about why Britain wants to update Trident. I find it very, very difficult to justify, oh, we'd better hang on to it because things are very dangerous in this very, very uncertain world. Now, coming to your question, the problem, I think, is this dreadful word that has entered international politics over the last 10 years of exceptionalism, that our survival allows us to be exceptional about this or exceptional about that. It's not very nice, but we, the United States, will support India. The management of AQ Khan's program, that really they knew that this thing was developing, but they wouldn't do anything about it because, after all, we could possibly massage it in terms of supporting our own security. I think the real exam question that you're getting to is this. Where is the NPT now? Is it of any value, or are we seeing it in its last throes? The question was actually put by one of the more hawkish of the world's foreign ministers, Alexander Downer of Australia. And I think that where we're looking at it now is, can it be made to work? We can talk about the moral equivalence, but in terms of real politics, the foreign policy of the US, of the senior NATO allies like Britain, actually they do not see, unfortunately, perhaps they should, equivalence between Iran and Israel, because Israel is our guy, and Iran is the uncertain,
is
the unknown out there.
I mean, is, you know, is, Israel has not threatened to attack another country.
Except that Israel, I think I'm more sceptical than you about Israel. I think there are things that are very worrying about Israel's Israel's posture at the moment. As you say, it has a known and now admitted by Prime Minister Olmert, by world standards, quite a considerable nuclear arsenal. We know that last year they were egging the Americans on to take preemptive action against potential Iranian nuclear facilities. They were bought off. We have had trails ever since the September the 2nd attack, the aerial strike on the so-called nuclear site in Syria. A remarkable article by a man who's usually a moderate in the Israeli military community, Professor Martin Van Creveld, wrote a few weeks ago in the International Herald Tribune. It proves that we can do it. There is this idea that that this is the major threat. It's the major threat to the nuclear proliferation treaty regime, and something must be done about Iran. Now, they are trying to establish a casus belli, this element of thought. I don't think that they have established this casus belli, and I am very worried about saying, Israel hasn't threatened anybody, and after all, the president of Iran, I don't have Farsi, so I don't know exactly what he said and in what circumstance and to what audience. It seemed to me a very particular audience he was talking about, the so-called, much quoted but very rarely established in the original words, the so-called, we must wipe Israel off the map. I think this leads us, again, to go back to where I started, down a very difficult and very dangerous route of arguing exceptionalism.
I think the critical issue here that we should be thinking about, should anyone have nuclear weapons? You know, we heard from the first speaker about, that there were countries for whom, nuclear weapons would be in safe hands, and then there were ones we should be worried about. I do not know of any safe hands, any government that I would consider to be safe hands for nuclear weapons. And so it's not just a question about trying to repair the regime so much as what do we need to do to make it basically to abolish nuclear weapons across the board for everyone, as we've done with biological and chemical weapons, those two other great weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, come back to me on that, Alan. I mean, why are some countries safe and others not?
Firstly, they're democracies. They're accountable to their own populations, let alone anywhere else. Secondly, they've demonstrated over time they're not going to use those nuclear weapons. That's the other thing. We've had numerous examples of Iranian officials mentioning nuclear bombs and various the so-called moderate. And Mr. Rafsanjani mentioned 7 years ago he wished someone in the Muslim world would use a nuclear bomb to wipe out Israel. These are statements from people in power who've used that. Now, no British leader has used such terminology.
But there have been US Congress people throughout, since from 1945 on, starting actually with the Korean War, who did advocate and argue for, America to nuke somebody. Of course they were, but the point is...
Are you saying they're equivalent to a leader, someone in a leadership position like our manager?
I am as deeply concerned by much of what Ahmadinejad says and stands for. But the issue is actually about, first, Iran does not have nuclear weapons. Iran is a pluralistic society where you actually need to create the possibility for the democratic opposition and for the opposition in general and those seeking human rights to develop the opposition. Now, every time, President Bush saber-rattles about using the threat, the possibility of a future Iranian nuclear weapon as a casus belli, as they did with the WMD in the case of Iraq. Every time they do that, they recruit, tens of thousands more people behind President Ahmadinejad, and allows him to turn diplomats who have been trying to call for reason on nuclear issues.
I don't agree with you.
He has accused diplomats and scientists, people that I've spoken to and worked with, who are trying to to get reason and rationality into the nuclear debate in Iran, he's been able to accuse them of being traitors, precisely because the more you push at him and accuse him and threaten the use of force or threaten war against Iran, the more he knows that the people
will
support.
All right, let's hear from the audience. Gentleman at the front here. Next to you, that's it. Yeah.
Hi there. You said that liberal, democratic, secular nations are fine to have nuclear weapons because they wouldn't countenance the use, and no senior politicians, you said, have ever done that. But in December of 2002, Jeb Hoon, who was Secretary of Defense of this country at the time, actually said that with regards to attacking Iraq, if British troops were attacking Iraq, and they used, the Iraqis, in defense of their national soil, chemical or biological weapons, Britain would contemplate the use of nuclear weapons, which is an escalatory first strike use. How does that jibe with your
right,
sort
I mean,
of they're so reasonable
to be fair,
and
he
rational?
Didn't actually use the word nuclear, did not pass his lips. He said we will use all available means, and that was taken as meaning nuclear. But respond to that element, Mendoza.
Well, the point is, firstly, if you're being attacked by such weapons, then that's self-defense. That's defense. That's not attack.
When you're
defense.
Attacking somebody else's country, no, it's not.
It's not proliferation treaty.
Okay,
there's a difference.
Robert Fox, you're
you'd be breaching the nuclear proliferation treaty because it says no first use. And I think that this is where this rather theological argument, if I could put it that way, it really leads us nowhere. The problem about the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty and regime and those for and against, they do not get across the point that it's an absolutely lousy insurance policy. Particularly in a multilateral world, any contemplation, first or second use, of nuclear weapons is joining a suicide pact. Very, very interesting thing that's just come out of the documents from the National Archive. Dennis Healey, when he was Defense Secretary, was asked privately in a private briefing, what do you think should be in the envelope to a nuclear submarine commander with a ballistic missile abroad as to what he should do in the light of a known and established nuclear attack from the Soviet Union? That's what they were frightened of in time. And Dennis said, typically, I would tell them to do nothing, because it means the whole darn thing, idea of deterrence has failed completely, and we're toast anyway. I added that last bit.
Rebecca Johnson, I mean, you know, is the arms control regime, as represented by the NPT, one of the main planks of it, is it really worth anything?
Well, the NPT is the central treaty, but the fact is that since 1968, we've built up a lot of interlocking, interconnected treaties and agreements and different kinds, things like UN Security Council Resolution 1540, which attempted to expand, you know, to deal with non-state actors, with terrorists, if you like, who might acquire the materials or even, you know, buy or steal a bomb. And it was necessary for the regime to be expanded to that. Now, I actually believe that the non-proliferation treaty, which has this discriminatory element of between the haves and the have-nots, is unsustainable. I agree with Robert in this, that we need a kind of integrated approach to disarmament. And what we actually need to do is convert that regime to a full prohibition regime with you know, and take all those steps. It's not going to be easy, but it's actually a lot easier to verify the elimination and then the prohibition and then the non-production of nuclear weapons than it is for chemical or biological, which theoretically could be made in your kitchen.
Okay, Paul,
so
Paul
if
Ingram,
we could do it then, we could at least take the initiatives to do it now.
Is that realistic? I mean, are the nuclear weapon states ever going to agree to that?
It's the only option. I mean, it's not actually a question I would like to address head on, because it may or may not be realistic.
Well,
but the only alternative is proliferation of nuclear weapons. If we were to get rid of the NPT tomorrow, then there would be large numbers of new entrants to the nuclear world, and that would be horrific. So while I agree the NPT is discriminatory, it is not fair. The way in which the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is used can appear to be very discriminatory. It is nevertheless a mechanism that is essential for us to use today, but we have to. It is not sustainable if we see it as a rock, as a sort of solid, immovable thing that will always be there, because it is, as I said in my opening, is unsustainable the way it is. We need to see it as a dynamic instrument, not a
solid. Okay, another question now. Daniel Fitzpatrick. Daniel Fitzpatrick, your question.
Just returning to the question about Israel, I was wondering if they allowed inspectors and monitoring of Israeli nuclear capacity, or even if they encouraged and Israel joined the treaty, would that help with relations with neighbouring countries in the Middle East?
If they allowed the inspectors into Israel, if Israel allowed the inspectors in, would it help, Robert Fox?
I would say very definitely yes. Because I think that this is, there are a whole lot of, it's a very interesting question, because there are so many other things bundled into it. And the problem with the whole story of Intifada II, and I know that it isn't about it, but it has become related now, is this inability to reach out and talk to the other side. The demonization of very difficult and very threatening organizations in certain aspects, like Hamas and Hezbollah.
Let's stay on the nuclear thing here.
But no, it's right in the middle of this. If Israel could join the world on this very, the international community on this very particular issue, it would be very, very important indeed, and it would make it much easier to stop the very process that we've just heard about. We are on the cusp of a very serious breakdown in controlling nuclear proliferation, because if the whole diplomacy on Iran goes wrong, we are likely to see at least six other countries going within a matter of months, if not years, very quickly to get to nuclear status. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, Brazil, for a start.
We're coming up to the break, but Alamandeza, tell me why. Should Israel admit weapons inspectors? Should it sign the NPT?
That's something that Israel can sign. I think, as from an international perspective, yes, I think we'd all like to see Israel join the procedures and make it all above board, whatever. But the point is, I don't think it would make any difference to how neighbouring states treat us. Well, firstly, the neighbouring states are so terrified of Iran right now, they're delighted Israel's got the nuclear weapon. Is there any guarantee of protection? So speak to the Gulf states right now. Speak of Iranian insurgency in Bahrain and various places like that, and you'll see exactly what Arab states think of Iran. That's why they're all coming to Annapolis right now to discuss this topic. And although Annapolis may not actually yield what is wanted on both sides, nonetheless, they're there because they realise Israel's actually their ally, finally.
Okay, Paul Ingrid.
Whether that's true or not, the point is that Israel couldn't join the treaty with nuclear weapons because it's not capable of, given the terms of the treaty. I think, to be honest, to answer your question specifically, it is impossible for Israel to join the treaty as a nuclear weapon state and have inspections.
To join the treaty, yes, but not to join the regime.
But no,
through the Fissar Materials negotiations, Fissar Material Treaty, the comprehensive test ban treaty, which they signed, but
true,
have not
but
yet
I think to,
and
I haven't
the regional WMD free zone.
True, but I think, there are things that they could do, but I think essentially there is only one solution to the Israeli situation, and that is for them to give up their nuclear weapons. There is no need, even from an Israeli perspective, for nuclear weapons, because they have a vastly superior conventional
capability. We're running out of time. We have to take a break, a short break, but don't go away. We'll be back in a few minutes for more topical discussion on Forum. Welcome back. We're talking about nuclear proliferation and the arms control regime, and our next question is from Abbas Zahedi. He's a student. Abbas, your question.
Hi there. Well, I want to expand on Robert's point and ask what the repercussions of Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon would be on the international community.
I'm going to take that to Alan Mendoza first.
Well, very bad will be the sort of repercussions. I mean, essentially what Iran at the moment is already engaged in all kinds of what you might term unwholesome behavior. It interferes in its neighbours' activities in Iraq. The principal cause of the instability today is because of Iranian involvement in what's going on in Iraq right now. Which is. You think that, but it is actually true. We've already mentioned the Bahraini insurgency that's happening as well, again funded by Iran. Iran funds international terror already. Hezbollah, Hamas, and various other connections that are now coming to light. When you trace the money trail, you see where those things go. The regime already perpetuates human rights abuses on a grand scale. All of these things would be actually given more strength by Iran having the cover of a nuclear weapon to say, right, we can get away with what we're doing right now, even more now that we have the safety of the nuclear shield, if you like.
Rebecca Johnson, the fact is Iran has sent weapons to Hezbollah. I don't think there's any dispute about that. The Israelis intercepted a whole shipload of them not that long ago. not that long ago, less than 10 years ago, it was taking Western citizens hostage.
Well, I'd like to answer this question because I think it would be absolutely appalling for the Iranian people and for the region in the Middle East and for the rest of the world if Iran were to get nuclear weapons. But I say that from a position that says that I do not think there are any safe hands, that I think that what we actually need to move, and I think that our best option actually for bringing Israel also into getting rid of its nuclear weapons is a regional approach, and that would both deal with the peace and security issues, including the issue of the rights of the Palestinians, and the concerns that Israel has about its own security, given that it's not just Iran, it's other countries in the region have refused to recognize and have issued at different times threats of different kinds against Israel. So I think we need to deal with the peace and security concerns that Israel has. We need to deal with the peace and security concerns the Palestinians have, because that's an absolute major, you know, cause of problems and destability. We need to get the American and the British troops out of Iraq, and we need to build up a regional zone free of all weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, and there's some of us now, this is, you know, the whole of South Latin America and the Caribbean became a zone free of weapons of mass destruction at a time when actually people forget Brazil and Argentina both were developing nuclear weapons, and both were you know, with military governments and trading the kinds of insults and you know, giving great concern. And through the context of developing and building up a zone free of nuclear weapons in that region, it was able to build confidence and security. I think that, you know, it was very convenient for Israel to see all the Arab states and Iran sign up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, because Israel then became a free loader, if you like, a free rider on the regime. But now, partly because of the perceived threat if Iran develops a nuclear weapon program, and the fact that a number of other countries, you know, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, various other countries are now talking about getting a nuclear energy program, but everybody really knows that that's shorthand for saying at least having the infrastructure that could turn into a nuclear bomb, because nuclear energy is the technology to make nuclear weapons, even though that you can put bars in the way. So already other countries are hedging their bets. And so the thing is that Israel, I think, now is recognizing it is absolutely not in Israel's interests to see a weakened or a broken non-proliferation regime. So if it doesn't want to see that, it has to start playing along with the instruments of the regime. It has to start negotiating. It has, as an earlier question said, it has to start letting the inspectors in.
Are they doing that?
But I think...
Are they doing
well,
that?
I know that they are rethinking some of those elements. Of course, it's you know, everything is kept so secretive there, and I know they have a lot of concerns because they recognize that the writing is on the wall for Dimona, frankly. And so I think that the first step, and it'll be a baby step to begin with, is actually to get the countries of the region together to start looking at what in peace and security and, you know, WMD and verification terms would be required, how they could get a zone free of weapons of mass destruction in the whole Middle East so that none of them are threatened by chemical, biological or nuclear weapons. It'll take time, but I think the first steps have to be taken now.
Okay, Robert Fox, take me through the consequences for the wider region of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Everyone else would want them too, right?
Yes, I think it would be extremely worrying. Not only would everybody else want them, but principally the Gulf Cooperation Council would draw in behind Saudi Arabia, so would Jordan, very likely. They would be very worried about it, and I think Turkey and Egypt, they're the ones in the region. The one other element in the region which we haven't talked about in any detail yet is Pakistan. What effect would this have on Pakistan, who actually has the weapon? In fact, I think it's, you will probably have got from my body language, I am far more concerned today about what kind of regime is going to emerge in Islamabad and possibly in its ally in Kabul. Islamic, pro-Taliban, quite possible, not probable, possible. Where does that put them? And if it then becomes a virility contest, if it is not seen as an insurance policy, as a protection policy, but something, as I say, for use, for pursuing a policy, an aggressive policy, this worries me hugely. And I think this is the real test of the whole nuclear proliferation treaty, as you rightly say, Rebecca, the regime, not the treaty itself. I think it will be horrendously difficult. I am very worried by the Gulf countries. They are very, very well armed. I think they could be tempted to do some things precipitously, not preemptively, precipitously, to take action along the littoral, the shorelines of the Gulf, and it would be very, very dangerous indeed. I think that this is the problem with the current layers of influence and government and governance in Tehran at the moment. One wonders how solipsistic they are being, how much they are working to their own conception, their own construction of reality, and really understand how delicate the moment is. Leave the mood music of the American Enterprise Institute, the well-known Hawks, the Richard Pearls of this world, the Elliot Cohens, leave that aside. It really is a very delicate moment for everybody, and we could go very quickly into this thing, not only of proliferation, but very possibly a real contest of people out of fear feeling that they have to act violently to save themselves and save the world very quickly.
Paul Ingram, isn't that the danger, that Iran actually could be putting itself more at risk by having a nuclear weapon?
Yes, I think that is crucially the danger. I think there is some recognition within Tehran that that is the case, otherwise they would have pursued it much, much, much more vigorously. I would reframe the question. I would say, what is the danger of Iran going down the nuclear weapons capability? Because I think that's probably a more realistic, more likely policy that the Iranian regime is currently engaging in. That is, not having a nuclear arsenal, but having the capability to put one together very rapidly. Now, I think we're seeing signs of a lot of the things that we're talking about in terms of danger arising from that situation, not just from the deployment of a nuclear arsenal. And I think that it demonstrates the weakness of the current inspections regime in terms of actually preventing a country from acquiring capability. It shows that the capability, not the arsenal, also knocks on in fear and creates instability. And I think it's therefore important, critical, for the Iranian regime to understand that it's not just their possession of nuclear weapons, it's their possession of the capability that creates fear and instability in the region.
Questions from the audience, sir. Gentleman in the middle there, yeah.
So I was just going to ask, I mean, I still don't hear why the danger is so much greater there than it is here. I mean, we have nuclear weapons. Why aren't we at so much danger as they are in Iran?
Okay, let me take another point. Gentleman right at the back there. Yeah, right at the back.
I return to the recent report of the head of the IAE. In that report, we can find a very positive point of our activity of Iranian policy about the nuclear power, and also some negative point. I haven't seen any positive point in the media, and so far rarely anybody have any comment about this positive, unless that we know that it is a peaceful program for the Iranian, but
okay,
we haven't heard such a thing.
What the IAEA said, they did say that they couldn't say Iran was lying anymore, as it had done in the past, but they also said they knew less and less about the Iranian regime.
And they did make positive points, and it was taken up, I'm afraid. I do disagree with you. Both the New York Times and its country cousin, or sort of cosmopolitan cousin, the Herald Tribune, did point this out. And they quoted Baraday in extensively.
The UK newspaper talking about this affirmative and positive point of the nuclear power in Iran. Many of them talking about the negative.
You said all. Now we've moved to many. No, there has been some positive.
I
do
assure
you.
I corrected many of them.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, but let me just
see,
again.
If you look through the report, you can see a lot of positive points.
Yeah. Okay.
Many of them commit themselves to the inspector.
All right.
Of the
another question from the audience. The guy just in front of you. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi. I think the key issue, as we mentioned a couple of times, which is the fear, because when you ask the question, why do countries want nuclear weapons, surely it's real or imagined fear, external fears. And if you look at all the countries like North Korea, Pakistan, that develop nuclear weapons in response to Indian weapons, and Iran, and that, at least with Iran, it has a history of external interference, you know, for decades. Can I ask a question? If countries like this are persuaded not to develop nuclear weapons, what is the international community going to give? At the moment, I don't see Iran being offered any incentive.
That's a good point. Alan Mendoza, I mean, look, Iran is surrounded now by Western-influenced regimes. Iraq, Afghanistan.
Influenced by Iran, not by the West.
Frankly, it's at the moment got a very large number of American troops in it.
But nonetheless, Skiri and Co. are absolutely taking instruction from Iran.
Nonetheless, it does have a very large American force in it, as does Afghanistan. Anyway, look.
Well, we can have a debate about that.
This is
a question from the audience about the fear that Iran feels that may be leading it to develop the bomb. Isn't it reasonable for Iran to feel encircled by American power?
Well, what's Iran got to worry about? If it behaves itself internationally, there won't be a problem. If Habib persists in funding international terror, supporting insurgency movements, so on and so forth, of course it's got something to worry about.
We should be taking sanctions against Saudi Arabia in that case.
I agree with you, we should. Yeah. And you're going to have to scream with me on that point. Absolutely. Yes. But the point is, if you step out of line, if you meddle elsewhere, you're going to get caught with your fingers in the cookie jar. And unfortunately, if the regime was truly happy just to keep within its own borders and not go beyond that, then there wouldn't be a question to answer. There wouldn't be a problem in terms of it being afraid of what America might do in response to its own actions.
There's
another point there. Let me just show off the second point, which is, we were saying about, I think it was a point, in fact, I forgot the point. What was the point that you were...
The point about, there were several points about Pakistan coming in from the audience. I mean, answer me this. Pakistan is not a democratic country. Pakistan has been sponsored. It has sponsored terror in some forms. It sponsored the Taliban for many years. Why is it all right? Why is nobody talking about sanctions on Pakistan?
They should be. The point is, I think everyone has been pushing recently to push Musharraf down this democratic route. What he's done is utterly unacceptable. And slowly, slowly, people are waking up to that fact. They've backed the wrong horse over the past few years. What they should have been doing is supporting democracy.
So you think we should have sanctions on Pakistan?
I do. I think it's interesting the Commonwealth suspended them, and I think things are going to move beyond that now because of what's happened there.
Okay, question in the middle there. Yeah, go in the polo shirt.
Just in response to your point, haven't America and the UK somewhat got their fingers in the cookie jar and evading Iraq with no nuclear weapons or any evidence of that? I mean, who's to say that Iran can't have their fingers in the cookie jar, whereas lots of other people can? I just don't understand that point.
All I can say to that is, and maybe my colleagues will disagree with me again, back in late 2002, early 2003, all the intelligence agencies were saying there were nuclear weapons. They even Saddam's generals thought he had.
No, they weren't. I'm sorry, but they weren't saying that.
Weapons of mass destruction. Sorry, you're quite right. Weapons of mass destruction.
I didn't say there was a nuclear program.
Okay, weapons of mass destruction. But are you going to disagree with that? They did say that the weapons of mass destruction.
They said they didn't know whether or not. And Blix went in, Hans Blix went in, did the inspections. He could not, and he went in with intelligence direct from the UK and the US government. He checked out all the places where they said he should look. He came back and he said, I couldn't find anything there, and I couldn't say from that there was absolutely nothing, but, basically, if there is, it may be residual.
All right, Rebecca Johnson, answer me this. I mean, whether or not you disagree with the war against Iraq by the US and Britain, do two wrongs make a right? Does that mean it's all right for Iran to
absolutely not countries? I've been absolutely clear since the very beginning that it is not right for any country to threaten others. I am very, very concerned about the Iranian nuclear program. Unlike probably most people here, I've visited at least one of the uranium facilities in Iran in the last couple of years. One of the reasons why you have to forgive some of us for the skepticism, the IAEA has two roles. One is to promote nuclear energy around the world, and then the other is to stop it getting turned into nuclear weapons. But those of us that have worked for years and years and years to stop our country, Britain's nuclear energy program being turned into nuclear weapons, to stop the French nuclear energy program being turned into, and so on and so forth, and South Africa and these other countries, we have, frankly, you have to forgive us for the skepticism of knowing that when a country like Iran, or when now Egypt is talking about wanting a nuclear energy program for peaceful purposes, what they're wanting is a nuclear infrastructure that would at the very least give them a technical option. And that's of very grave concern. But not because I'm worried about Iran being less responsible with the bomb than Pakistan or than Britain, frankly. I'm worried that nobody with their hands on the bomb, and particularly with motivations for regional power projection, which I think is a very big part of Iran's wanting to pursue this, was a very big part of India pursuing it, and then Pakistan's bomb was really a response to India's nuclear power projection.
Okay.
That these all feed into and destabilize. So if Iran gets the bomb, others will seek to find some counterweight, right, and the nuclear non-proliferation regime will collapse, and we will all be in danger.
Let me go back to the audience. Back to the audience. Gentleman in the middle there, the front. Mm. At the front.
Quite sceptical about the whole debate. I think that it reeks of hypocrisy, because I think nuclear weapons, obviously they are terrible, but the entire issue about Iranian nuclear weapons is about preserving hegemony. Those that have the weapons want to keep the weapons. Those that don't want to have the weapons want the weapons. If I'm going to ask a question to our friend from the Henry Jackson Society, if a state that is undemocratic and its nuclear armed is so terrible, what are you going to do about China?
Let me put that to Paul Ingram first, and then Alan Mendoza can answer later.
Can I say that on the directly, you are right, it is full of hypocrisy. But I think if there's a top-line thing I would like everyone to remember from this, is that there's more to life than simple rights and fairness. There is global security, and there is our future. And our future lies in trying to tackle the spread of nuclear weapons and the disarmament of nuclear weapons. So just because, and I'm there at the barricades with you when it comes to British nuclear weapons, American nuclear weapons and the like, but, you know, just because Britain and America and other countries and China are causing instability, ultimately, in the longer term, certainly, by their possession of nuclear weapons, doesn't mean to say it's right for other countries to then see that and then accept the situation, because if they do accept the situation, if they then choose to go to join that club, either legally or illegally, then it will lead to all of us having instability, and sooner or later, and probably sooner, a nuclear conflagration. And I tell you, if nuclear weapons are exchanged, all those people who talk about climate change being the biggest threat to the planet are living in cloud cuckoo land. A nuclear exchange is horrific.
Come back to him.
Paul's actually element. Right. I mean, let's be honest. The two sides of the proliferation disarmament debate do need to be taken together. And, you know, everyone does need to be looking at reducing their nuclear arsenals, and preferably at some point to zero. But you can't have reduction to zero when you have a state like Iran, which is creating instability, trying to gain nuclear weapons. That means people want to keep their nuclear weapons and others want to get nuclear weapons.
You can't have reduction to zero when you have a state like Britain off the west coast of Europe with no direct threats, with you know, Tony Blair even recognising that, you know, nuclear weapons were not going to be any deterrent against terrorists and so on. A country like Britain, nevertheless, arguing that it needs to spend £76 billion on a new generation of nuclear weapons to take us to the year 2050. On the arguments of an insurance policy or of an outdated notion of deterrence that arises in the Cold War that could not help us deal with any of either the security or the military threats, and would certainly make climate change
a lot
worse.
All right, somebody else from the audience wants to come in there.
This is not directed to any specific person, but what I'd like to know is, if this language of diplomacy fails, what course of action is going to be taken afterwards? Will it lead? Will it go down the same road as Iraq?
You're speaking specifically in relation to Iran here. What do you think, Robert Fox? What's going to happen? Actually, what is actually going to happen?
Well, I think that we've got, as played so strongly, frankly, in what had to go off in the mind of George W. Bush and his supporters in the spring of 2003, and it's called an electoral timetable. I feel if we can get through the next 4 months, I think that, you know, that people will be thinking again about a United States-led, a United States and Israeli preemptive strike on Iran, and then there is time to think again. I think one of the most eloquent pieces of discussion has been from Dr. Gary Sick, who was involved with Reagan and with Bush Sr. on the whole question of nuclear proliferation in the region. And what he has said is that really, we do have to say that this is terribly, terribly difficult. Henry Kissinger famously talked about his in-tray, his out-tray, and his too difficult box. This really is in the too difficult box, but we cannot leave it there. And it's because, gosh, we don't know whether to trust them. But by the way, my reply to your thing about hypocrisy, absolutely right. But one person's hypocrisy is another person's practicality. And this we are in new territory here. I do not see the preemptive strike option should be considered at all in these circumstances, because as happened in Iraq, the unintended consequences were many, many times more than anybody possibly could have expected at that time. And I think it might even inadvertently trigger the feared regional nuclear arms race that we have spoken spoken about. Imagination is needed. We've got to get out of the Cold War approach of superpower blocks. We're still thinking of those terms in the way that we engage in diplomacy, but it is Jaw-Jaw and not War-War, and that's the way it's got to be.
Alan Mendoza, do you think there could be military action? I mean,
Yeah, there could be. I mean, principally, if diplomacy fails. I think what everyone needs to make sure is that diplomacy doesn't fail. There ought to be ways of talking to Iran and getting Iran or signing off with concessions, whatever, to talk Iran down from this. There should be, but it can't help when Russia and China refuse to join the game on that. Now, then you've got a failed multilateral diplomatic track, and at some point, you have to decide, when are we at that tipping point, when diplomacy's run its course and we can't get everyone to agree on the diplomacy, then people who are really concerned may have to take action. And at this point, hold on, I'm on the Chirac and McCain camp. Anything worse than Iran, you know, having the bomb, bombing Iran, is Iran having the bomb?
Yeah, there's absolutely, you couldn't tolerate that at all. That's absolutely out of the question.
I think the consequences, as have been outlined by everyone around the table, would be horrific if they had the bomb.
Paul Ingram.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I think it would be bad for Iran to have the bomb, but it would be worse for us to invade or to bomb and create the instability. If we bomb, they're going to get the bomb, you know. Mm. It's going to be ineffective even in its own context, because it will give huge political pressure within Iran that does not exist today behind a nuclear arsenal, and they won't be going for capability, they'll be going for a deployed arsenal.
Okay, I'm going to take one point from the audience and come back to Rebecca Johnson before we finish. The gentleman in the pink, in the purple shirt there. Just speak up to for me when you get the microphone.
Why is that only USA taking the lead in attacking other countries and not the other countries?
All right, Rebecca Johnson, take that in your own.
You know, I think the Bush administration has been a profound disaster for international security, and when Tony Blair went along with that, instead of trying to prevent the attacks on Iraq, we are all going to have to pick up the pieces and try to put back together a more, a stronger security regime based on cooperative and collective notions of security. And we have actually got to recognize that security is not just about having the biggest weapons on the earth, which of course the United States has. It's about knowing when to use them and when not to use them, how and how not. And this was where the United States politics completely failed and ended up not only making U.S. security, not only weakening U.S. security, but gravely weakening security in the Middle East, destabilizing the Middle East considerably further. And as a result,
what's
we
your
are
answer to the
danger.
Question, what do we do if Iran won't talk, if diplomatic efforts come to nothing?
We have to actually keep engaging. Remember, North Korea also it got itself to a pitch point after being identified as part of this so-called axis of evil. It pulled out of the treaty. It developed enough material to actually do a nuclear weapon test. And having sort of done that, there was a change of people in charge in Washington, and the talk started again. And in fact, now the IAEA is there. We're getting rid of their nuclear weapon program. Okay. I'm not saying that the same would happen with Iraq,
Rebecca,
but
we've got to stop,
the use
afraid,
of force
I'm
would be disastrous.
That is all we've got time for today. But if you want to continue the debate or suggest something else for us to discuss, then our email address is forum@presstv.co.uk. That's forum@presstv.co.uk. See you again next week for more topical debate on Forum.